Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 3, Episode 21 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. As always, I would direct you to the show notes where you will find a comprehensive running order of what we discussed and when during this episode. However, I will provide you with the usual brief overview. In Germany, we discussed 22-year-old Nico Schlotterbeck's importance to Freiburg, both in defence and in attack. Schlotterbeck will, of course, be moving to Dortmund at the end of the season, but we explained why, notwithstanding that aforementioned importance, Freiburg can be confident that they will be able to absorb Schlotterbeck's departure fairly comfortably. As it so happens, after we recorded that particular part of the podcast, Freiburg announced that they would be signing Matthias Ginter on a free transfer from Borussia Mönchengladbach at the end of the season. That, in my eyes anyway, is the type of sensible recruitment with which Freiburg are so synonymous these days. In Spain, we dissected a really quite brilliant Copa del Rey final between Real Betis and Valencia. Elsewhere in France, we asked ourselves what Monaco's future might look like with or without their highly coveted sporting director, Paul Mitchell, while in Italy, we put Salernitana's heroic Serie A survival bid under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. I woke up on Sunday morning to a message through the night from none other than Joe Donoghue. Joe is, of course, the voice of Scouted Football, and Joe sent me a recording of what looked like an underground club in Hamburg and the Road to Nowhere song, of course, Talking Heads song, was playing. And yeah, Joe was singing enthusiastically, to put it one way. So that was quite the clip to wake up to on Sunday morning. So Joe, I know that you listen religiously to the podcast. A huge thank you to you for that. Yeah, it went down well. And I, of course, shared the clip with Barlow and Michael, and they too enjoyed your wonderful singing. So thanks, Joe. Feel free to share more clips of you singing in the future. Moving swiftly on, Michael Jones is with me, looking gorgeous with his buzz cut and beard combination. Rudy Barlow is otherwise occupied. We'll dial him in later in the episode. But yeah, as I would say, Michael Jones, you're with me. You're present and correct. How are things with you, Michael?
Yeah, really good, thank you. I also really enjoyed that clip that Joe sent over. And I guess just use this opportunity, if any of our other listeners do ever find themselves in a similar situation where the Road to Nowhere song does come on, please do send it our way. We promise it will just be for our entertainment purposes only. But yeah, it was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would echo what you're saying there, Michael. If any of our listeners are in a club, whatever that club may be, perhaps a Bristol club, maybe, I don't know, or an Edinburgh club, or yeah, maybe you're in Buenos Aires all the way in Argentina and you hear the Road to Nowhere, please do share a clip of the scenes in the club with us. We would absolutely love that. Now, Michael, enough on Talking Heads, more on European football, and in particular, more on Italian football. AC Milan left it late, but secured a huge victory at home to Fiorentina thanks to a late goal from Rafael Leao at the San Siro. That win was all the more important considering their title rivals, Inter Milan, dropped points earlier in the week versus Bologna. This was the second consecutive game in which the Rossoneri had scored in the final few minutes to snatch a huge victory. With three matches to play, Milan are 2 points clear at the top of the Serie A table. Michael, to what extent has their character put them in this favourable position heading into the final few weeks?
Yeah, I think it's been absolutely massive. I think it's that the character has characterised this AC Milan team this whole time, really, under Stefano Pioli. And maybe what we saw last season when they were in that title race with Antonio Conte's Inter Milan, sort of up until the late winter period before they dropped off quite rapidly and found themselves in a battle for top four, which in fairness to them, they did achieve when that at one point looked unlikely. I think these are all cumulative things which are really building together for what could be a really big finale for AC Milan. And yeah, these two victories really did have just defined that in recent weeks. The one against Lazio, we saw players coming back into the team who haven't featured too much this season, albeit key players, the likes of Ante Rebic and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Both really played their parts in that. Zlatan was the one who assisted with the winner. And against Fiorentina as well, it was another really dramatic victory. AC Milan, you know, only a few weeks ago, they looked like they were sort of doing what Inter Milan had done in recent weeks, but maybe kind of epitomises the twists and turns in this title race and why we still need to be careful when, you know, putting one team as firm favourites. But they looked like they almost run out of ideas in that draw versus Torino, and we're very complimentary of the work Ivan Juric has been doing up there. However, yeah, against Fiorentina, they've responded brilliantly, albeit they did rely on some goalkeeping. Mike Maignan was absolutely sensational, making a point-blank save to deny Otto Cabral. And I just think, in terms of some of the setbacks they've had with huge players departing, you know, in the past year or two, the likes of Hakan Çalhanoğlu and Gigi Donnarumma as well, they've responded so valiantly, and Maignan has been maybe the signing of the season in Serie A. If not, he's up there with maybe another player that I'll come on to very shortly, also sporting the Rossoneri red and black, of course. And I just think they've been fantastic. I think Rafa Leao has been a driving force. He's sort of ball carrying this season has been a number of progressive carries he's been carrying out. He carried out 17 against Lazio. It's just a constant threat during that match, just gliding past players. And we're really starting to see the evolution of a player who, despite being still in the kind of formative years of his career, is really grown into a key player in this team now. And albeit he's maybe still not getting the numbers that the chances he gets should provide, he's still... A lot of the maybe mistakes he is making are ones that certainly can be fine-tuned and aren't the signs of a player who isn't maybe going to go right to the top, which I think he is. And I think he's showing that. And he's maybe playing some of the best football, if not the best player in the last few weeks in the Serie A. He's been absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I think overall there's just been a beautiful blend of young and old players competing for roles. We talked about Zlatan, Olivier Giroud, Simon Kjær, who of course has been injured for a few months, but I think that's also given them tactical flexibility, which is maybe a bit understated when looking at this AC Milan team. And whilst we do love to sort of praise them for that character, they've the sort of different options they have in the likes of Zlatan and Giroud that they can ping long balls for, but then they've also got the likes of Brahim Diaz, Rafa Leao, Ante Rebic coming back into the team now, who can just drive the ball up the pitch, play sort of made powerful runs between the lines as well. And that variation has really maybe helped them navigate situations in the second half of the season, which arguably Inter Milan haven't been able to do. But I just finish off and come back to that character, and I just say it's huge. I think there's a great recent example with Fikayo Tomori, who, you know, we've seen more and more British players move overseas in recent years, but Fikayo Tomori has been maybe the standout in the sense that he's really tried to grasp the Italian culture, seeing more and more attempts of him. Every time he's doing an interview now, he's attempting to speak in Italian. And even though I don't speak Italian, from looking at the translations and the reaction to it, it's something that's improving rapidly. And going in, you really get the sense of a sort of siege mentality complemented with smart recruitment, not just in terms of the young players and their potential, but also their attitudes and willingness to adapt to the culture. And I think it's just generated such a positive environment, and that's been ultimately cultivated by Stefano Pioli. They've got three games left now in what could be, you know, a first title victory in 11 years, Hellas Verona, Atalanta, Sassuolo. None of them are in amazing form, but have demonstrated their giant killing capability enough times over the last few years. And for all the plaudits, this AC Milan team are not infallible, which kind of gets to the reason why we're praising them in spite of that. But it's going to make for a fascinating end to the Serie A season. And at the moment, they are deservedly favourites.
At the other end of the table, Salernitana's remarkable race to beat the drop took a cruel twist after Mario Pasaric netted a late equaliser for an out-of-sorts Atalanta against the Granata on Monday night. Nevertheless, that result still leaves the club in a position they would have scarcely considered possible just a few weeks ago, thanks primarily to the excellent work from Davide Nicola, who has doubled their win tally for the season in their past four games with a three-game winning run. Where would Salernitana's surviving rank amongst similar heroic feats, Michael?
Yeah, it's interesting you've mentioned Davide Nicola and Salernitana. I think we've become familiar with managerial experts for keeping teams up, but he's potentially in this conversation in the league of his own, and maybe is in competition with his previous feats when we're ranking Salernitana's possible survival and survival in the Serie A. And in terms of him, his most eye-catching achievement previously was with Crotone, who he kept up in the 2016-17 season. Just for a bit of context, he was actually there for the whole season, unlike this time at Salernitana, where he's joined halfway through. But they had just 9 points halfway through with this Crotone side in January of 2017. And after getting their first victory away from home in the April before the end of the season with just a number of games left, he promised to cycle from Crotone to Torino, which in terms of the geography of Italy, that's basically cycling from the heel of the boot right up until the front zip. And he did it. It's a 66-hour cycle, according to Google Maps. But there's sort of a heartwarming reason for it. His son died just age 14 from a road accident as well. And I think in terms of Nicola, maybe it just gives you a bit of an idea in terms of the enigmatic character that he is as a manager. And he's been key to Salernitana's revival in what looked impossible circumstances. We discussed at the start of the year the sort of change in ownership situation with Claudio Lotito, the Lazio owner, who was also the Salernitana owner, and by rule of in sort of Italian football, they weren't allowed to keep that and had to get new ownership and seen a massive overhaul in players. But the way in which Nicola has galvanised the Salernitana team, it did take them a while to get victories. He'd been there for 8 games, and the first 4 games saw 3 draws and a defeat, albeit the draw one of the draws was three draws and 4 defeats, and one of the draws was against AC Milan, and they've been absolute, but they've sort of there've been real signs of progress, and people weren't writing them off for a reason. And if we look at the sort of recent victories against Udinese, Fiorentina, and Sampdoria, they've been absolutely fantastic. He's changed them into a 3-5-2, and he's got this midfield trident that's just really, really effective. It's got a young Norwegian midfielder, Emil Bohinen, in the middle, with Lassana Koulibaly on the right-hand side, who those, including yourself, Ali, may remember from his time in Scotland with Rangers, and Edison on the other side as well, a young Brazilian midfielder. And there is that belief again. And Nicola, for all the sort of interesting things about him, you know, he was famous as a player for once kissing a policewoman after scoring a goal in the 90s, amongst some other sort of controversial things he did. He's clearly a very passionate manager and capable of galvanising players. And just also really quickly, Eddie kept Torino and Genoa. He's kept Torino and Genoa up in previous seasons as well. But I think sort of finishing on the, you know, we come back to the ownership, the player turnover, what they've gone through this season is, you know, they were facing expulsion from Serie A. So I think even if there is no bike ride that's not been promised yet from Salerno, which is also in the south of Italy, which would be far if he was to go to Turin, I would say this would rank as maybe the most impressive survival story in Italian football. their last four games are Venezia, Cagliari, Empoli and Udinese. Probably winnable on recent form, especially Cagliari sacking Walter Mazzarri. So let's see what happens. But really a miracle story in Italy could be in the making.
Indeed, Michael. Now, arguably the most eye-catching scoreline from game week 35 saw Napoli dismantle Sassuolo 6-1 at home. The victory was even more startling when we consider Napoli's collapse in the race for the Scudetto. With a fully fit squad, Luciano Spalletti's side ultimately lacked the consistency required to be champions. Why is that, Michael?
Yeah, I think intensity. I would say intensity's kind of been key to that. And there's been a few reasons behind that, whether that's been fitness level, strength in depth, disturbances by AFCON earlier in the year. But also in terms of the playing personnel that they have, I think one of the things, you know, we just discussed with AC Milan in terms of those attacking players, Leao, Diaz and Rebic, players who can really sort of change the pace of a game. I think that's something that maybe Napoli just haven't had. And I think it's maybe given them a real lack of variation when trying to break teams down or manage games in terms of players carrying the ball up the pitch when they were winning, which is exactly what happened when they collapsed at home to Empoli not too long ago, which ultimately sort of seemed to finish off their title chances. You know, they were 2-0 up going into the final 10 minutes and had just absolutely blew it. And also with a sort of calamitous goalkeeping error as well. But I think it's a really interesting time for Napoli sort of going forwards and sort of reflecting on this season, because whilst it is easy to criticise them and say ultimately they've had a really positive season under Luciano Spalletti, who's kind of really worked off a lot of the sort of best qualities that their players have. They've been a really precise team when they have been at the best going forward, really intricate moves in the final third, which was really well on display against Sassuolo when they won 6-1 again. In terms of sort of that intensity, maybe there's question marks regarding that in terms of, you know, have the title chances already gone now? But it could be quite an interesting time for Napoli going forwards as well. We know the news about Lorenzo Insigne leaving to join Toronto, maybe Victor Osimhen's future's in doubt, which I think would be a big blow. But personally, I think he needs another season, as I don't think he's got close to that price tag that they did get him for from Lille just a couple of years ago. But I think it's really exciting times for Napoli overall. And whilst they'd be disappointed that they've got nothing to show in terms of trophies for this season, getting themselves, they look a certainty to be back in Champions League football for the coming season. I just would really think what lessons need to be learned from that kind of intensity, that theme of intensity, is that they maybe do need to have a bit more of a different type of playing personnel in terms of, so that there is a bit more variation to the play. But overall, disappointing that they've fallen off, but overall a very positive season.
Perfect, Michael. Thank you, as always, for that enlightening coverage of all the latest goings on in Italy. Well, we are going to head to the south coast of France now. We're going to dial in the excellent Luke Entwistle from Nice, and he's going to talk to us about Monaco just along the coast. We'll be right back. Monaco are the most informed team across Europe's top five leagues, winning their last seven league games in a row. That run has seen Philippe Clement's side climb from 8th to 4th in the league and table, rekindling their hopes of playing Champions League football next season. To dissect their impressive recent form, I'm delighted to be joined by Ligue 1 connoisseur Luke Entwistle. Basing himself in the gorgeous city of Nice, Luke is a sub-editor at Get French Football News and a frequent contributor to Monaco Life, Monaco's leading English language news source. Luke is also a regular on Ligue 1's official English language podcast, Le Beau Jeu. Luke, it's great to have you dialing in from the south coast of France. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me on. I'm grand. It's a lovely part of the world to be in. It's a lovely warm day here in Nice, so can never have any complaints, I'll say.
Absolutely. I've been to Nice before, and one of my favourite cities in France. Many favourite cities in France, but yeah, slightly jealous of the weather, I do have to say. But yeah, I suppose the weather in the southwest of Scotland can never really compete with the weather in the south coast of France. But we'll move on. Now, I want to speak to you firstly, Luke, about Monaco's remarkable transformation over the last 6 weeks or so. Now, their 1-0 loss to Strasbourg on 13th March was their third loss in four Ligue 1 games. And just a few days later, they, of course, crashed out of the Europa League with a 3-1 aggregate loss against Braga in the round of 16. Since then, however, the Principality club have gone from strength to strength with that 7-game winning run, including vital victories over the likes of PSG, Rennes and Nice. Holistically speaking, how has coach Philippe Clément been able to instigate such a positive turnaround at the Stade Louis II, Luke?
So yeah, you rightfully referenced there some of those pretty dreadful results that preceded this crazy run, which, by the way, is their best run of results since January, February 2021. So it's a very long time since they've put together such a consistent run of results, especially in Ligue 1. Those games that you referenced, particularly Braga at home in the second leg, was a particularly damning result. You know, it really did hit rock bottom at that point. It wasn't just the loss against Braga, who were perceived as the weakest side in that draw. When that draw was made, you know, you kind of, on a personal level, I was kind of saying, either you get Barcelona and you get the spectacle, or you get Braga and you get through that. And, you know, they ended up getting Braga, and your expectation at that point is that you then advance through that. As they were the worst kind of, I think, UEFA ranked side left in that competition. So the fact that the first leg didn't go their way, they lost 2-0 away in Portugal, was a surprise. But there's definitely this idea that they'd reverse that trend when they came back to the Stade Louis II. It didn't happen. And it never looked like happening, truthfully. And I think that was what was most damning, more so than the result, was that it's not like they pushed and pushed and knocked on the door and just didn't manage to knock it down. It's that there was not too much huff and puff about it. They just kind of, maybe being a bit harsh, they kind of rolled over. So that was a low point. And then only about 3 or 4 days later, you've got PSG at the Stade Louis II. So you're not holding out too much hope of that going your way. Before the match and during the match, there's fan protests, lots of different banners, kind of, you know, remarks aimed at more or less everyone within the club, apart from the owner himself, you know, about the players, about the sporting director, for example. You know, there's really no one apart from the owner was not targeted by those kind of fan protests. And the feeling around the club wasn't great. L'Equipe, the night before, posted this article saying that the owner was going to get rid of the sporting director, the vice president, Oleg Petrov, so that Paul Mitchell is the sporting director. And Philippe Clément, the coach, was going to be, they're all going to leave as part of this mass clear out, regardless of the result against PSG. But to everyone's surprise, I think, Monaco won 3-0 in that game, dominated from start to finish. Should have been way more than 3-0. And it was certainly a surprise. But when we spoke to Philippe Clément afterwards, he was very much kind of forcing the line that, you know, we were kind of saying, well, you know, surely this must give your side a lot of confidence now. And what he was saying is that we were already confident. There was already a great dynamic within the side. And it's, you know, this is just kind of showing that. Anyway, 2 weeks later, you've got a 2-week international break, which I think everyone kind of needed. I think it was well-timed. Most people stayed in La Turbie, stayed in Monaco, because not many of them went on the international break. Notably, Golovin, who always plays the 90 for Russia due to the sanctions imposed on Russia, stayed as well in Monaco. And then what you see the other side of that international break, where you've had those six wins in a row since that PSG match, is just honestly a completely different side to the one that we've seen all season. I say Golovin was an important factor because he has looked better than he has looked all season, probably for most of the last season as well. He's really kind of refound himself in that playmaker role and has been quite decisive in the final third. But really, you could go throughout the team and say that really all of them have upped their level physically, tactically. That 2 weeks, I think, was just a bit of a blessing for Philippe Clément, who could do lots of physical work, which is what was mainly done according to all the players, a little bit of tactical. But I think it seems like that physical work, that physical training that was done by all the team that stayed, at least, really reaped some rewards. So, I mean, I'll pick out a couple more players who've really, really kicked on. You know, Youssef Fofana, who didn't, he was great the latter part of last season in Monaco's run towards the Champions League spots then, alongside obviously Aurélien Tchouaméni, hadn't looked comfortable for large swathes of this season. Suddenly picked up his level again, back alongside too many. He hadn't necessarily started too many games, but he's come back in and now he's undroppable. Equally, Ruben Aguilar has come in, looked really solid, having been kind of not a peripheral figure, but he was really battling it out with Sidibe and obviously for a time Vanderson, who's now playing slightly further up. But that right back slot is very much his. And then, you know, I mentioned Vanderson, he's been a bit of a revelation since coming in January. He's really made a difference and he kind of invigorated their season. And then Volland, who's in a more of a 4-4-2 now, is really Ben Yedder's partner, also looking really solid. And Clement actually revealed that he was suffering since the start of the season from a little ankle niggle, which is now, he's the better side of it. He's feeling physically better, and that does show on the pitch.
Now, just before we turn our attention to the club's future, I was wondering if you would perhaps be able to give us an insight into how Monaco are perceived generally by the rest of French football. Now, their average attendance of 5,712 is the lowest in league and by quite some distance. And geographically speaking, anyway, they are somewhat isolated from the main body of the league. So would you be able to give us an insight, yeah, into how Monaco are perceived by the rest of French football?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a regularly trotted out joke, the attendance figures of the Stade Ludo. As you say, they are the lowest attended on average, below Angers, who I believe have around about 7,500. Monaco's is around just over 5,500, I believe. So by a relatively considerable distance. And when Nice came for the derby a couple of weeks back, all of the discourse it felt online was all about, we're going here to show you what it is to experience an atmosphere, a football match. Obviously, they came there and lost. But that is, it's very much a regularly used joke. Monaco are the butt of those kind of jokes on a more or less weekly basis for whoever visits. I mean, yeah, you speak about geography a little bit. I think that does influence a bit. The Principality of Monaco isn't huge. There aren't huge numbers of people who live there. Just down the road, you've got Nice, who have a decent sized following, a much bigger city. Just, you know, a little bit further down the coast, further, you've got Marseille, even further, you've got Montpellier. So you've got a real host of great football teams all the way down that coast. And Monaco are kind of right up that top end, you know, very close to Italy. I think that does influence a little bit, you know, they've got a smaller net, perhaps, than other teams. But, you know, you can go really micro with this. You know, you can look at transport options for getting to the games, which I'm not sure if you know too well the train system in France. But if you're looking to get the train from, say, Nice to Monaco to watch the game, you're going to get there. But if it's an evening match, you're not getting back. That's just the reality of it. So, you know, you can go really micro with these kind of things. I think there are lots of factors playing into it, larger one, you know, to varying degrees, they impact on that. But Philippe Clement recently said, he wasn't critical of fans. He was very much saying that, well, it's up to us as players, as coaching staff to entice people to the stadium. You know, we need to seduce fans. We need to play good football. We need to play attacking football and we need to get good results. And that's the good, you know, that's how we're going to bring in the fans. And I think that's a fair point as well. So you'll find Champions League matches, Europa League matches, big attendances, PSG, Nice, Marseille, Lyon to an extent. They're always going to bring in the big attendances. It's the rest of them that, you know, that brings down that average throughout the year. And it's also just worth noting this year in particular as well, that whilst the restrictions on attendances in France were lifted earlier, in Monaco, they stayed in for a few weeks longer. So that is also having a little bit of an impact because they were still limited at, I believe it was 5,000 for I think maybe about a month or so longer. I can give the exact figure and date, but I think that is also dragging the figures down a little bit.
That's interesting to hear, just that sort of local knowledge of, yeah, how Monaco are perceived and some of the factors at least behind the fairly low attendances. I was lucky enough to go to the Stade Louis-II for the game against Marseille. That would have been, I think, maybe September 2018, yeah, and it was a cracking atmosphere. So I think on its day or on its night, you know, the Stade Louis-Doux can be a great place to watch football. The fans on both sides were making a really good atmosphere. So I think, yes, it should be, in my opinion anyway, a stadium which should be on every football fan's bucket list. It's a surreal place to watch football.
It's a beautiful stadium. Yeah. I think it's a truly unique stadium.
Absolutely.
You won't find another one like it in the world. So yeah, if you are a bit of a footballing nomad and like to travel around to some of the great stadiums, that one 100% has to be on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think the one word that just kept going through my mind was surreal. Just the principality itself, the stadium, just totally surreal. And yeah, a great place to watch football. Absolutely somewhere that any footballing nomad should look to go at least once in their life. Okay, now the 5 years since Monaco were crowned Ligue 1 champions in 2017 have been characterised, I think it's fair to say, by volatility on and off the field of play. The most recent development in the principality has seen sporting director Paul Mitchell linked with a move away to the Premier League in England. What would Mitchell's departure mean for Monaco? And more generally, what does the future hold for the principality club look?
So that's a difficult one. I mean, I think you can credit Paul Mitchell with, you talk about the volatility, and 100% it's been a volatile club in the past. You know, you can win the title one year and then almost get relegated the next. That was the boom and bust kind of culture of Monaco at the time. Rybolov left since the owner has decided to install, obviously, Paul Mitchell as his sporting director. One of the main aims of that is, of course, to provide some level of stability so that you're not chopping and changing managers as they were. You know, you'd go from Hardin to Thierry Henry to Moreno, and there didn't seem to be a lot of joined up thinking. It seemed like it was a club that was lurching from one era to the next without any kind of plan. And Mitchell has brought that kind of plan. You can see it in his successive managers. You look at Niko Kovac and Philippe Clement, and you see a consistency in play style, for example. You see a consistency in ideology with regards to bringing through young players, to name a couple of, you know, little tropes that they definitely have. So that's a big thing to note immediately, is that Paul Mitchell, I think you can credit him with bringing to an end, to an extent, that boom bust cycle of the club and bringing a level of stability. Now, it'd be very unclear as to what would happen if he left. Obviously, he's been linked with Chelsea, apparently a couple of the bidders, which we don't know. I know it's according to The Athletic that a couple of those bidders are keen on bringing him in as the sporting director, should their bid be enough to buy the London club. Also, very understandable links with Manchester United due to Ralf Rangnick, and they've worked together at Leipzig. I think they're quite close on a personal as well as a professional level, as far as I'm aware. So yeah, there are a natural links for him to leave. And in terms of what it means if he does leave, it's really unclear, because currently there are all the rumours about him leaving, but there's no rumours about anyone who'd potentially replace him. Now, I do think they would probably look to hire almost immediately to go in back into that role. But what kind of figure they'd get, it's hard to say. There are rumours of other changes in the hierarchy. There's a rumour that persists about Oleg Petrov, the vice president, who... there is constant chatter about him leaving at the end of the season, whilst Juan Sartori, who also has stakes in Sunderland, for example, is touted to have a slightly increased role. We don't know what that role would be, but it's hard to say exactly the impact it would have, just because we don't know what would succeed him. So it's all about, having some kind of idea as who they'd bring in afterwards. I feel as though, now that Rybolov has decided on, he wants this kind of structure with a sporting director, you'd assume that he'd be looking to fill that role should Paul Mitchell leave. Who that would be and whether or not there'd be a success is a completely other matter. But yeah, I'd say that Paul Mitchell has definitely brought a level of stability to the club. And although some fans perhaps aren't always the best pleased with his decisions in the transfer market, you know, people have been frustrated by a few of the signs in the summer. Ismail Jacobs, Sean Lucas, for example, aren't necessarily the fan favourites for now. But people like Vanderson, Volland, you know, there are some real good signings in there as well. So he's definitely brought in some good players, brought a level of stability and consistency and continuity to the club, which it lacked before that.
Absolutely. Look, well, thank you very much for giving up your time. I'll let you go and enjoy the French evening. We'll be back very shortly after a quick break to discuss Spanish football. But before then, look, I just want to take a moment to say thank you to you for giving up your time.
No, thanks very much, Alistair. It was an absolute pleasure being on.
In Spain, there's only one very obvious place to start. Last weekend, Real Madrid were crowned champions for the 35th time after a 4-0 victory over Espanyol. In what was a party of a match which then spilled out onto the streets of the Spanish capital, full disclaimer, this has been recorded before they play Manchester City in the second leg, so we may have decided Carlo Ancelotti is a fool and Real Madrid are finished by the time you listen. But how do we evaluate their domestic season, Barlow?
Yeah, it's pretty hard. I mean, football, for the very simple reason that you obviously have your targets and everything, but you can't really count on how the other teams are going to do. And so I think this season, I think if we go back to the start of it, a lot of people had Atletico Madrid as favourites to win the title again. Before kind of sort of the exodus of Barcelona's forward line, when it was Leo Messi and Antoine Griezmann up top, some people were thinking that maybe Barcelona would put in a challenge because they did come back in the second half of last season. So I think Real Madrid were obviously always going to be in and around it. And some people did have them to win the league, but it wasn't a certainty by any means. Whereas now it kind of feels as if it was always likely and always sort of the course that Real Madrid would win this league. But it certainly wasn't the case at the start of the season. If we go back to the start of it again, very few of us thought that they would have the squad to be able to push this far in the Champions League. There was the concerns about rotation, which we've mentioned. I think anybody who's kind of tuned into Spanish football coverage over the last kind of 6 months will have heard somebody mention Ancelotti and his rotation policy, his lack of it, and how they kind of thought that that would cause a drop-off. But so far, kind of so good. I mean, they've been missing David Alaba for these Champions League semi-finals, but if you look at all of the other teams in the Champions League semi-finals, they've been missing key players too. So I don't think you can really criticise them on that kind of basis. They won the league under Zidane a couple of years ago. Yes, that's kind of true. But this is a squad that's a couple of years older that hasn't really brought in great amounts of investment in the last kind of summer or two. I mean, Camavinga has come in and he's obviously a very, very talented youngster, but he's not sort of top level just yet. If you look at the fact that Ramos and Varane have both gone, and both of them have gone on to kind of look worse than they are, I think, in their sort of current seasons. But that was kind of the spine of a Real Madrid team for nigh on a decade. And to have replaced them with David Alaba and Eder Militao, I don't think they're quite as good as the previous pair at their best. But they've been pretty seamless this season. And the way that he's managed to sort of get those moments out of Luka Modric, Karim Benzema has taken a step forward again, partly because of that Vinicius development and the fact that Vinicius has come through. I mean, some people say that, well, Vinicius was likely to make the step anyway, regardless of the manager, but Vinicius himself credits Ancelotti with giving him the confidence, giving him sort of the presence and the calmness of mind to be able to attack in a better way, to make better decisions. Because before, I think we very much had him in the sort of Ousmane Dembélé, and he's starting to make better decisions now, but the Ousmane Dembélé mode of somebody who was really, really good, and you could see he caused a lot of problems, but when it came to the final third, quite often he'd make the wrong decision. And I think sometimes the fact that there's an interesting quote that I came across from Manuel Pellegrini last week, and he said that 90% of the success of football management is managing the group. Maybe it's a little bit of an over sort of valuation of it, but it certainly does bring home that for Ancelotti, I think he is incredibly good at managing the group. He's a little bit different. He's an older manager. He doesn't speak the same way about tactics or football in the same way that Klopp or Pep Guardiola does, or Thomas Tuchel. And I think that kind of works against them in kind of how the media portrays them, because to be honest, I think the media and I understand why, because they don't want to get into technical details as much. I think that we tend to think that they are dumbed down coaches, that they don't know what they're doing, when I also think it kind of distracts from the things that they do bring. And Zinedine Zidane, who's a younger coach, suffered from the same thing because he didn't really sort of get into tactical details. And both will probably say that they're no tactical masterminds, they're no geniuses sort of on the tactics board, but in other ways, they do make up for that. Yeah, I think if we look at the history of Real Madrid in the last kind of 20 years or so, look at kind of group of managers, the ones that have done best, Zinedine Zidane, Carlo Ancelotti, Vicente del Bosque, all of them have been more of a hand on the tiller than sort of a very kind of micromanaging, this is what we must do, these are the roles that we must kind of fulfill. If you look at Rafa Benitez, went very poorly. If you look at Julen Lopetegui, also went very poorly. Both kind of system managers before kind of man managers, if we want to simplify it down to that. Even Jose Mourinho. Mourinho is incredibly good at man managing, but very much implemented a system. And he was up against a really, really good side, but wasn't successful by Madrid standards, to be honest. And so the criticisms that we've leveled at him can't really sort of bear up. I don't think this Real Madrid side have a sort of just claim to be in the Champions League final. And you can make the argument that Ancelotti's making those mistakes and that's what's causing these kind of deficits that Real Madrid keep having to come back. But I think that calmness that he brings and the sort of experience of it all, the fact that he's lost the Champions League final being 3-0 up, means that when the going gets very, very tough, Ancelotti is there and he knows how to sort of get through those moments and how to focus a player's mind. And a lot of this is also down to the players. Let's not wrestle credit for them. But yeah, I think if you were to describe this season to me from the start, I'd have to say he's excelled. He's above expectations. And part of that, again, is because of the lack of challenge that he's had in La Liga. But it's been an incredible achievement, I think, just to get this far. And if they do get to the Champions League final, if they do win it, then I think he's beyond reproach, to be perfectly honest.
Speaking of honours, both of the major domestic honours were decided since we last recorded in Spain, with Real Betis winning their third Copa del Rey. After a 1-1 draw, it all went down to penalties and just one of the 10 was missed, but it was a Valencia one. This was a really good final though, Barlo.
Yeah, it was 1-1, but it kind of had that intensity and both sides kind of played with plenty of ambition. I think it was a really good clash of two more or less evenly matched sides. Betis had a kind of spell domination in the first half. They took the lead within the opening kind of 15 minutes. It was a very, very good goal. But I think the overall message from this, or the overall kind of feeling that I took away from it, was just, it was really good for the health of Spanish football. It felt very kind of wholesome. There was two massive fan bases, as you can say, going against each other. There was a lot of respect between the two, with, for want of a better word, there was none of the that comes with the big teams. And this was the second final in 3 years without any of the big three in it. It's those two kind of finals, the previous one being Real Sociedad's beating of Athletic Club. Those two finals are the first time that there's not been a member of the big three in the final for about 13 years. And so it does show that, and I should mention the Copa del Rey kind of changed format recently. It went to a system where before the semi-finals, it used to be two-legged. Before the semi-finals, it's now one-legged. It did show if you just kind of tip the balance a little bit back in sort of the favour of kind of the teams with less resources and you even it out a little bit, then it does make for entertaining football. I think it's been one of the most exciting Copa del Reys that we've seen in a long time. But yeah, it was a great game. Both teams could have won it. Valencia had a spell sort of in that second half, right after halftime, when they were excellent on the counter. They were breaking into space. I think Bordalas comes under a lot of criticism for his style, and okay, but they were playing good football in this final, and you can't kind of reproach them for the way they approached this game. Betis, as I say, they had a spell kind of early on in the first half, and their goal, it comes from a very kind of Pellegrini goal. Nabil Fekir picks it up in half space, sort of lays it out wide for an onrush to Bellerin, who then crosses for Borja Iglesias. It was very kind of reminds you of Pellegrini. And then there was also the Juan Miranda story, which I'm sure plenty of people have kind of seen doing on social media, but it's sort of a story of a 22-year-old left back who came on in the final, came on an extra time, but he was a Betis fan. He was at the last Betis Cup final in 2005 when he beat Osasuna 2-1 an extra time, and he was on the pitch, took the winning penalty. He takes it and then he drops to his knees, and you can see it, the sort of sobs kind of leaving him as he's on the floor. It was incredibly emotional. I think even if you weren't a fan of either team, you kind of got pulled into this story. But it felt kind of almost like a vindication, I think, for Real Betis. I mean, we've said that they're doing very well, and we've said that they've done a sort of very good job. Pellegrini's done a good job, and this felt like kind of a materialization of this, a kind of a set point to say, well, we've achieved this, instead of just getting into Europe. And it's nice that they have a trophy for that. I think it's good for them. It's worth remembering that in the last two seasons since Pellegrini came in, the only player they've signed for money is Germán Petzela for $3.5 million, which is pretty remarkable. And I know that they had invested before. They have like a big squad with a lot of quality in it. But if you compare it to, say, Villarreal, who have done it excellently, but they were also the second highest spenders in Spain last summer. Yeah, I think it felt like a healthy match. It felt like a very sort of pure footballing occasion, which is kind of rare. There was very little of the crap that kind of accompanies Spanish football at times. And yeah, it was just a really good occasion more than anything.
One of the most fashionable teams in La Liga for a good chunk of the season was Rayo Vallecano, who fell off dramatically since January and thus have lost a lot of eyes. But after two wins in Catalonia, they're practically safe. The second half of the season may not have been vintage, but this Rayo Vallecano are still worth talking about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Andoni Iraola came out after they beat Barcelona at Camp Nou. They won 1-0. And he came out and said, well, yeah, safety's more or less kind of achieved. And now they have reached 40 points and they're not mathematically safe, but they're pretty much there. And it, again, I think you have to measure these things against the start of the season and what you kind of expected of them. They've done their first ever double over Barcelona, which is pretty incredible. And that most of that second half of the season, it came without Falcao, who provided sort of the goals and the finishing touches to some of their good moves in the first half of the season. I think if I go back, I think for La Liga Lowdown, we did kind of season predictions. I want to say 10 out of the 11 of the sort of team there, I want to say 10 of us had Rayo Vallecano going down. And for them to save themselves with kind of 4 or 5 matches to go shows just kind of the enormity of this achievement. They came up with a squad that most of us largely thought weren't good enough for the first division, didn't have the sort of pedigree for it. Falcao is kind of an exception to that, but Fran Garcia probably at left back is another name that people would have been aware of and would have been aware of his talent. But this wasn't a team that people thought was cut out for the Primera División. And I look at their team now, and Oscar Trejo is one of the leading assisters. I think Alejandro Cadena, Ivan Bayou, Santi Comesaña, and Oscar Valentin in midfield, all of them, I think, will stay in the first division after this season or beyond if Rayo Vallecano decides not to keep them. Alvaro Garcia, Isi Palazón, they've been excellent going forward. I think there was one point that Alvaro Garcia was linked with kind of the Spain team, and that kind of shows you just how incredible they were in the first half of the season. Isi Palazón, he almost has this kind of Messi-esque kind of cut in and then sort of plays the ball over the top, sort of an arcing in behind the defence ball for Alvaro or Fran Garcia on rushing. And it did kind of remind me of the Messi-Alba connection because it happens so often, but it's so hard to stop. Yeah, overall, we've just seen a very good football team who did something remarkable in the first half of the season. They kind of got a lot of their points. And the fact that there's been a kind of tail off in recent weeks, it's going to detract away from their achievements. But they've achieved safety, big feat for the side, and they've done so with very little fuss. I'm very pleased I mean, beyond the kind of fact that they beat Barcelona, but I'm very pleased that they managed to do it at Camp Nou in such dramatic fashion, because I think they deserved a moment like that. They deserved sort of a crowning moment to illustrate how big this achievement was. And so absolute credit to them, credit to Andini Iraola. It's worth remembering that this is a club at Silver War that has a lot of off-field politics interfering with their team. And so, yeah, nothing more than a chapeau to Rayo. We'll take a break now. I'm going to hand back to Ali, who's going to tell you about a team from the Bundesliga, which is doing similarly incredible work.
In Germany, the latest chapter in Freiburg's Black Forest fairy tale saw Christian Streich's side reach their first ever DFB Pokal final for the first time in their history. They'll face Leipzig at the Olympiastadion in May as they look to win their first major trophy. Before then, however, the affable team from Germany's southwest have two more league games to play, with the top six finish and another European jaunt firmly in their sights. So placing Freiburg under the road to nowhere microscope, what have been the main factors behind the club's truly remarkable season, Ali?
Michael, the sight of Freiburg lining up and whipping a corner into a packed six-yard box almost certainly strikes fear into the hearts of Bundesliga defences. And looking at the numbers, we do have to say that fear is totally rational. Freiburg have scored a staggering 19 goals from set pieces in the league this season, and that's more than any other Bundesliga club. Now, Michael, with set pieces, I do think there is a tendency to almost treat them with disdain. People do tend to almost scorn teams who are renowned for their set piece prowess, and there's definitely, I think anyway, a school of thought according to which any notable reliance on set pieces is unhealthy and rather uncultured, shall we say. But that mindset doesn't sit too well with me at all. Now, for me, the effective use of the set piece is a fine art, and evidently it's an art that Freiburg have mastered to devastating effect this season. Rhys Desmond wrote a brilliant tactical piece on Freiburg on his Mastermind site earlier in the season, and in that article he breaks down the way in which Christian Streich's side approached their set pieces. Now, I would highly recommend you go and read that article. It's a highly enlightening piece. Just looking at Freiburg's approach to set pieces in terms of personnel, you'll typically see Christian Günther and Vincenzo Grifo providing excellent deliveries for the likes of Nico Schlotterbeck, Philipp Leinhardt and Niklas Höfler, all of whom are highly effective in the air. Just looking as well at the heights of Schlotterbeck and Leinhardt. Schlotterbeck is 6'3" and Leinhardt is 6'2". So when you have players with the abilities of Christian Günther and Vincenzo Grifo when it comes to whipping crosses into the box, whether that be from a set piece or from open play, and then when you have the likes of Schlotterbeck, who does like to get forward even in open play into the opposition penalty box, when you have the likes of Schlotterbeck and the likes of Leinhardt getting on the end of those set pieces, then yeah, it's almost natural that Freiburg have enjoyed so much success from set pieces this season. What we tend to see from Freiburg is that they'll whip the ball towards the six-yard box, and as the set piece comes in, the likes of Schlotterbeck and Leinhardt will start to advance towards the goal and swarm the goalkeeper almost, and they'll look to get the ball over the line any way possible, often on the rebound. A lot of the time, the goals that Freiburg score are not particularly pleasing on the eye, but it is highly effective, this style of just whipping the ball into the danger area, getting it in the mixer, so to speak, and yeah, just hoping that the sheer mass of bodies can get it over the line, or they can fluster the goalkeeper, they can force a mistake, they can force a ricochet into the net. It is a case of anything really can happen. And yeah, as the numbers indicate, it's been a highly effective tactic for Freiburg this season. We only need to cast our minds back to last weekend, actually, to Freiburg's dramatic 4-3 win away at Hoffenheim, to see an example of these types of deliveries and that type of movement in the box paying dividends. A fierce Christian Günther ball from the right-hand side was headed in by Lucas Howler, who was practically on the goal line when he knocks the ball in. It's just, again, that movement of swarming the goalkeeper, of arriving late into the six-yard box, of timing your run to perfection. And yeah, it's worked so well for Freiburg this season. Admittedly, the delivery for that goal against Hoffenheim wasn't from a set piece, but it does provide us with a perfect illustration of the types of delivery and the types of movement in and around the six-yard box, which have served Freiburg so well this season. Now, Michael, Freiburg have been, perhaps unsurprisingly, the kings of the six-yard box this season. 12% of their shots have been in the six-yard box, which is the highest percentage for that particular metric anyway in the whole league. Specifically, they've recorded 50 shots and scored 17 goals inside the six-yard box, which is A, quite remarkable, and B, quite indicative of their general approach to creating chances. Only Dortmund have actually scored more goals in the six-yard box. They've scored 18, and Bayern Munich have scored 17. And when we think about teams up the top end of the table, they do tend to score quite a lot of goals in the six-yard box or in and around the six-yard box because they're able to, yeah, to create better quality chances. And I suppose it's not rocket science. The closer you are to goal, the higher your chances are of scoring normally anyway. Their set pieces and the threat they pose in and around the six-yard box have been two of the most defining aspects of Freiburg's game, certainly this season anyway. Just in terms of shape, I think it's always good to provide an overview of a team's shape. It helps you to appreciate their style of play more generally. Christian Streich has never really been wedded to any formation. That's been the case throughout his time, really, at Freiburg. He's always been willing to change things up in that sense. So this season, we've mainly seen them line up in a 3-4-3 or in a 4-2-3-1 formation, Michael, with a real focus on chance creation from the wide areas and open play, and then also really looking to leverage your set pieces to make the most of your set pieces when they come your way. And that all feeds into this intimidating control, if you like, of the six-yard box. Now, I have mentioned Nico Schlotterbeck a couple of times in this section. We've mentioned him before on the podcast. There's been a lot of commentary generally on his progress with Freiburg, and the 22-year-old's numbers continue to really impress, Michael. Just looking at some of those statistics, he's in the 96th percentile for tackles compared to his positional peers across the top 5 leagues in Europe, 91st percentile for tackles won, 89th percentile for interceptions, 87th percentile for blocks. And then just looking at how he ranks in the Bundesliga, he's third in the Bundesliga for tackles won this season, and he's fifth in the Bundesliga for percentage of aerial duels won. And obviously he's good defensively in the air, but he's also solid going forward in the air. I think he is so intimidating, him and Philipp Lienhardt, so intimidating for them to stand and to move as close to the six-yard box. It is only natural for goalkeepers, for defenders to get a little bit flustered and for mistakes to be made and for chances ultimately to present themselves. And yeah, when you're as close to the goal as Schlotterbeck tends to find himself, as Lienhardt tends to find himself, yeah, your chances of scoring are naturally going to be really quite high. Just looking again at Schlotterbeck, just yesterday, actually, it was announced that Nico Schlotterbeck will move to Dortmund at the end of the season. That's an excellent signing on the one hand for Dortmund, particularly when we couple that signing with the signing of Niklas Süle as well. I think Dortmund have addressed a huge weakness in their game, i.e. their defensive shortcomings. So it will be interesting to see if the signings of Schlotterbeck and Süle can instigate an improvement defensively for Dortmund. So yeah, on the one hand, it's an excellent signing for Dortmund, but on the other hand, Schlotterbeck will of course be a huge loss for Freiburg. That said, I think Freiburg's approach to recruitment and the sustainable way in which the club is run generally will reassure the Freiburg fans that they'll find a suitable replacement. Michael, Freiburg are the embodiment of this idea of the team as a collective whole rather than the team as a cluster of individuals, and that mindset I think will help them to absorb Schlotterbeck's departure. Obviously, he's been one of the most impressive young players in the Bundesliga this season, and yeah, when he leaves, it would only be natural for Freiburg to struggle slightly. But yeah, for the reasons I've just given, I think they're in a really good place to absorb Schlotterbeck's departure, and they're in a really good place to get over his departure really quite quickly. Before the 22-year-old does move on, Freiburg do, of course, have that not insignificant matter of their first ever DFB Pokal final. They'll be playing Leipzig later in the month, and Leipzig will naturally be favourites. But something about Freiburg suggests to me that they might be able to somehow pull off a historic and memorable victory. I've actually got a friend who's heading out for that game. He's from the southwest of Scotland, but he is a huge Freiburg fan. He's a member at Freiburg as well. So he's heading out to Olympiastadion for that one. And over and above that huge final, Freiburg actually find themselves in the driving seat to qualify for the Champions League with two games to go. Fourth place is theirs for the taking. Leipzig, of course, slipped up last night away at Mönchengladbach. That has opened the door for Freiburg to qualify for the Champions League. It would be a remarkable story for, yeah, one of the most likeable clubs in Germany. I'll be watching their final with Leipzig, their DFB Pokal final with Leipzig, hoping that they can record a huge victory. And yeah, I'll be paying a close attention to their final two games. Let's see how they get on over those next two games and over the final against Leipzig. Regardless of what happens, it's been another brilliant season for Freiburg, another brilliant season for Christian Streich. He is arguably the greatest manager currently managing in the Bundesliga, certainly in terms of the whole package that he has to offer. Brilliant manager, his press conferences are riveting, and his team, yeah, a lot of the times people say that Freiburg, it's effective football, but actually this season they've played some really good stuff, getting the ball out wide, whipping those crosses in, their corners as well. Everyone gets excited at the very least when Freiburg have a corner. It's something that you absolutely have to watch out for over the next two games. Let's see, yeah, how they get on. Okay, well, on that note, we are going to wrap up our analysis of the latest goings on. We've, of course, heard from Luke Entwistle. Do check out Luke's work. He is available on the official Ligue 1 podcast, and he, of course, writes for Monaco Life. Great writer, great guy, and it was great to have him on this episode. Michael Jones, thank you for your contribution. Rudy Barlow, thank you for your contribution. Until next time, listener, stay safe and stay well. Goodbye.